saving money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 228 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast, presented by Overdrive. It's a bonus Saturday episode.
Bonus Saturday. Clap, 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 clap. Reason being, we got a email from Simon and Schuster that were like, hey, you guys want to interview Jessica Knoll? And I said,
yes, please.
I said, yeah, I was queen. Jessica Knoll has a new book out this week.
Well, for those who maybe don't, she wrote The Luckiest Girl Alive.
I was going to get to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So Jessica Knoll wrote The Luckiest Girl Alive.
Do you want to start over again?
No, we're good. We're just power through. She wrote The Luckiest Girl Alive. It sold like 500,000 copies. That was her debut novel. She's a wonderful person. And then she had a new book come out this week called The Favorite Sister. And if you subscribe to our Trending Titles newsletter, it's prominently featured there, as is this podcast. So didn't want to just sit on this episode for a couple weeks because we have several Mondays already planned out. So you're getting a bonus Saturday.
Yay!
I got to talk with her for about a half hour. I felt really bad. The day we're recording this is Wednesday, and yesterday was her pub day. And like, if you follow her on Instagram and stuff, she was out and about doing events all evening. So we discussed the book in the morning, and she was a wonderful sweetheart, like being an awesome person, taking one for the team. She's like, if I sound like I'm very tired, I'm not hungover or anything, I'm just very sleepy. So I appreciate it.
I'm so excited for this one.
Yeah. Thank you, Jessica, for battling through. You're awesome. I'm not going to keep people waiting too long, but if they want to get a hold of us, if they have thoughts and comments, where can they find us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds, and you can email us at ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com or visit our website, ProfessionalBookNerds.com.
Yes.
I'm having issues.
So
this
close.
Morning.
You got through all of that other than
very, like very the addition of the website is totally tripping me up because had like my thing.
Uh-huh.
I had my thing.
And just a little spoiler for an upcoming episode, like a quick preview for you guys. Jessica talks about a book about a very, very big author that Jill interviewed who will be on in, I think, a little over a week from today. So
I believe that is correct.
Yeah. So wheels within wheels. Anything else you think people should know about?
No.
Okay. All right, guys. I'm still giddy because I just got off the phone with Jessica, and I hope that comes through in all my excitement here. You guys are really going to love this. I loved it. Go borrow her books. And first, enjoy this episode with Jessica Knoll on the Professional Book Nerds Podcast. Hey everyone, it's Adam again, and I cannot tell you how excited I am today to be joined by Jessica Knoll, whose debut novel, Luckiest Girl Alive, took the book world by storm, selling over 500,000 copies on its way to becoming a worldwide sensation. And she's following that up with her debut, she's following up her debut with The Favorite Sister, which just came out from our friends at Simon & Schuster. We're actually recording this the day after her pub day, so first off, Jessica, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And I told you before we started recording, I felt really bad because had I realized that, I would not have scheduled an interview for you the day after you were running around like crazy. So thanks for being a team player for me. I appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. And yeah, as I explained, if my voice sounds a little haggard, it's not because I'm hungover. I'm just way too wired to sleep right now. So I have not been sleeping well. So forgive me if I'm not as eloquent as I would like to be.
So we're going to like jump into the book and everything in just a little bit. But I'm just thinking, you know, this being your second novel and the first one being so wildly successful, I imagine even though there was hype around your first book when it came out, did this pub day kind of feel a little bit different to you?
Yes, a lot about this felt very different. I think because I know so much going into this one, whereas there was really an ignorance is bliss factor with Luckiest Girl, and a little bit of naivete on my part, like, oh, it's all going to work out, it's going to be so great. And then when it did all work out and was so great, everyone was like, this doesn't happen. And I was like, no, that's always what happens. And then you start to really realize just how rarely that happens, and it did take a lot of work. It wasn't like I just wrote the book and was like, okay, let's just let it see what it does. Mm-hmm. I did put a lot of work in behind the scenes, but I definitely learned kind of the tricks of the trade, like what helps the book in terms of visibility and sales. And so then you put all this pressure on yourself, like it's got to exactly replicate, you know, the course that Luckiest Girl took, and you can never do that. You know, it's 3 years later, it's a different, you know, it feels like it's the age of people finding books on social media, which wasn't really it was just starting when Luckiest Girl came out. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to just be excited to see what this journey is like, and, you know, where people are going to be talking about The Favorite Sister 3 years later.
Yeah, so you just touched on about a million things I want to unpack, but before I do...
I tend to do that.
No, that's a good thing. You literally, without knowing the questions I had planned to ask, you like kind of preset yourself up a little bit later here perfectly, so good job on that. But before we get into all that, would you mind kind of giving our listeners maybe an introduction to The Favorite Sister, just so they have a reference for the book we'll be chatting about?
Sure. So The Favorite Sister is about a group of five women who live in New York City, and they compete on a reality TV show that is a cross between Real Housewives and Shark Tank. And someone mentioned I should also throw Survivor in there, which I really liked because these women are survivalists. They mm-hmm. will do anything to keep their spot on the show, because once you're off the show, you're irrelevant. And they're on the show to promote their businesses. They're individually very successful women. It's kind of what sets them apart from the Real Housewives. Their lives are incredible and extraordinary, but they're not funded by men. Mm-hmm. They're all independently wealthy and successful. And so there's the usual, you know, there at times the women love each other, at times they hate each other, at times they love to hate each other. So there's a long history in the group, alliances that shift, and one of the castmates ends up dead. And so you know this from the very first page, but the mystery is who killed her and why. And the why is just as shocking as the revelation of who is responsible for her murder.
I love the way that you set up this story with, you know, it's so rare to see books where kind of the major plot point that everything is going to be revolving around takes place right away. So when you mm-hmm. when you came up with the idea for this book and you were starting to kind of plot it out and think through and, you know, working with your editor and everything, did you always intend on having that sort of like Tarantino-y working backwards from the action?
Ooh, I like a Tarantino reference.
Thank you. But was that something that you always sort of plan on, or did that just kind of come about as you were structuring it?
No, that was always the structure of it. And I think I was inspired by Donna Tartt's The Secret History, mm-hmm. which I mean, that's one of my top three all-time favorite books. And the first line, like, you can't beat it. Mm-hmm. And you know already that one of the members of this group of friends is dead, and it becomes a why done it, not a who done it. And that's my sweet spot. Like, I'm so much more interested in the why of crime. And I need to understand, like, what pushes a person to homicidal violence. And I like to work that out in my fiction. I think in a way it's like a therapeutic exercise for me. It helps me understand like the human psyche and helps me kind of put things into a box and tuck them away so I can fall asleep at night.
By the way, I'm absolutely stealing the loving the why done it as opposed to the who done it. That's
the who done it. Yeah,
that is perfect. So after, you know, Luckiest Girl Alive, it had this huge popularity, and after the fact, you kind of revealed in this Lenny letter that a lot of it was based on this truth of your own life, where you were sexually assaulted as a teenager, And I know that Favorite Sister deals with a lot of issues and barriers that women tend to face today, especially in America, when trying to become successful. So were there aspects of this story that were also kind of true to your personal story?
Yes, there's definitely parts of me and parts of my experience in this story, though maybe less identifiable than some of the, characterizations in Luckiest Girl. But yeah, I was thinking a lot about how successful and ambitious women are received. I was thinking a lot about how successful and ambitious women relate to one another. I had some experience there because I've only ever really worked with women after, and I went to an all-girls school from kindergarten to eighth grade, and then my first job out of college was at Cosmo and then at Self Magazine. And so for a good chunk of my life, I've been in my day-to-day with almost entirely women. So I felt I had something to say about the nature of sisterhood and how, you know, it's a concept that we should aspire to, and that when we are supporting each other, it's a beautiful thing. But also looking at the times where we do mistreat each other and kind of trying to work out why that is, whether are we innately like that? Is it society pitting us against each other? These were all things I was trying to work out in this one.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And I always hear, and my wife talks about it all the time when she'll like have these conversations with all of her friends, and then she'll tell me about it afterwards, like this, all like the sniping that goes back and forth. A lot of times when her friends or like she, when somebody in their group does something really incredible and successful, it's almost like there's always this subtle backlash. And then in preparing for, you know, this conversation, she and I were talking about that, and I realized like, I don't think that happens very often with men. I can't think of a conversation, maybe just because I don't care enough about my friends' successes or failures, which says more about me. But I mean, I feel like you're right. Like there's something in society that it's almost like women who are successful either have to like apologize for it, and that's absurd. Like you should be able to be successful and also praise other women for what they're doing. And I think, like you said, a lot of times it's almost like society doesn't let you do that.
Yeah. And I also think the traits that it takes to become successful are at odds with how we conceive of women to be, which is nurturing and caretakers and polite. And if you want to be really successful in life, you have to put yourself first. You have to have sharp elbows. And men do this all the time. And, you know, and they're not penalized for it. And they get everything they want out of life. And I just think it's a question of why can't women be received the same way? And I think we're starting to have that conversation. I think we're starting to realize these kind of unconscious biases we have toward women who exhibit these types of traits. And I think recognizing it is the first step to refusing to kind of participate in that anymore.
Yeah, and you very much kind of put yourself out there, and you don't just sort of say this internally. Like you wrote this incredible article for this opinion piece for the New York Times. I want to get the exact headline right. I want to be rich and I'm not sorry. And I loved the entire idea of this story of being like, you lay out exactly the fact that like you wanted to do something, you wanted to live your life the way that you are, and you had always aspired to this. And like, I just love the fact that you basically lay out, I wanted to do a thing, I wasn't surprised that I was successful because I'm truly talented. And I feel like I'm very fortunate that I have a lot of women in my life that are that way, but I feel like that's such an incredible message to show, not just, you know, women who may read the article, but I hope that mothers show daughters what you wrote, because it's so powerful. It's such a good message to show people.
Yeah, and fathers show daughters too. I mean, I did hear from a lot of men too, who applauded the essay and said that, you know, they hope to raise their daughters with this sort of boldness and fearlessness. So yeah, I think, you know, I think it shows a real shift in the culture that so many people, there was such a, you know, kind of galvanizing response to the essay.
And something that you had in there that I really loved is, you know, people might have seen the success of Luckiest Girl Alive and kind of assumed like, oh, you caught lightning in a bottle, and you know, there's this wonderful book that, for quote unquote whatever reason, has sort of like touched people's nerves and like really moved them a little bit. But I mean, the truth is, like, you did something that I've had conversations with other authors who were successful right out the gate as well. You did a ton of research into publishing a book and making it successful. So without giving away any secrets, because you did the work, you deserve it. but like, what were some of the things you discovered when you were realizing how you wanted to create and promote and push out your first story?
I think the first thing I realized was my job wasn't done once I finished writing Luckiest Girl, and even once I finished editing it. I think I had in my mind that I just, you know, delivered it to the publisher, and then I got to sit back and put my feet up, and just, you know, all the press would come rolling in because they would take care of it. And the truth is that, when you get a book deal at a publisher, you are set up with your own publicist, and they do work very hard for you, and they do get you a certain amount of press. But even that amount that they can get you, it's never enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so hard with any medium to connect with readers or viewers, and you really have to be everywhere. And so I quickly realized, like, oh, I want to pitch in and do my share, my fair share here. And also, I had made so many connections in the media over the years because I'd been a magazine editor, and I had friends at various publications and websites, and gone off to start their own podcasts. And I had so many connections, and it just seemed like it would be such a waste of all those years, all that hard work, all that networking, not to lean on them. And I do think requests like that are better received when they have that personal touch. So whether it was a friend of a friend introducing me to the girls who run the Skim, who then picked the book as a Skim Reads, which turned out to be like an incredibly helpful in terms of pushing the needle on book sales. Like, I was looking for like any vague connection to anyone who may be able to help, and I would not rest until I had exhausted them all.
I'm so glad that you said that, because it makes so much sense. I feel like sometimes people will feel shy or like afraid to ask. And in my mind, that's how we started this podcast. And before we started recording, I kind of told you, like, the reason we've had so many wonderful authors like yourself on the podcast is because, like, I'm just like, I don't care if someone tells me no. So I'll just ask. And more often than not, people will listen to you if you're willing to just be honest with them and like, hey, I'm looking to promote, like, in your instance, you know, I'm looking to get the word out about this book. Is there something that, you know, we can do together? I feel like a lot of times people don't realize that it can be, the first step can literally just be opening your mouth and asking someone.
Yeah, and I think, like, two things on that. I think conversely, you can be afraid of someone saying no and do it anyway, you know, like, because that's how I approached it. I hate asking people for things. I dreaded it with Luckiest Girl. I dreaded it again with The Favorite Sister. But I did it anyway. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's also something I want to make clear for people and for other, you know, aspiring young writers out there. It's not that I'm just comfortable doing this. Like, it's that I was willing to do something that made me uncomfortable, which was to do these asks with just like, ugh, like I get like a PTSD like shiver when I think about it, because it does make me so uncomfortable. And you know, also to your point that, like, you're not going to get anything you ask. You're not going to get what you don't ask for. It kind of goes back to the essay, you know, you're not going to become what you're not willing to say out loud. And I think that was very much the spirit behind the essay of saying, like, I want to make my own money. I want to live a certain life. You know, we need to be able, if these are goals, everyone has a different definition of success. But if that's your definition of success, if that is something you're striving for, you empower to act. It's only going to crystallize your goals and make it more likely that you'll reach them.
Yeah, I feel a really nice way to kind of like sum it up is there's a another wildly popular author. His name's Shea Serrano, and he wrote a book called Basketball and Other Things. It's all about the NBA and these different things. And the way he describes it is he just calls it shoot your shot. He's like, take your chance. If, you know, you do not make 100% of the shots you do not take from a basketball standpoint. And he's just like, you know, I wrote an absurd book about comics in the NBA, and now I'm a bestseller because I tried to do it. It's like that sometimes it's that first step of like, even if you're afraid of something, going after it. I fully, fully agree.
Right. And so many people want to write books and never do it. So even just publishing a book is an incredible accomplishment that everyone who has ever been a published author should be so incredibly proud of.
So in addition to doing all the market research and kind of realizing, okay, here are all the things I need to do to assure my book is successful, did you also look at sort of the trends in the style of writing that you wanted to, like what types of stories are selling and things like that? Or was it more so focusing on how to push the story out once it's done?
I think there was definitely, you know, a combination of factors there. I started thinking about writing my own book just a year or two out of college. And so I was young and I hadn't really read a lot of contemporary fiction because I was, in school, it was a lot of classic literature we were reading, and it was a good amount of books by men. So I started discovering women crime writers, and I was like, why haven't I just, you know, been reading all of these books for all these years? Like, they're just really resonating with me. I love the voice. I love the intrigue. I love that it's women getting to embrace their dark sides, and that very much spoke to me. So I knew I wanted to write a character like that. And then it was just a matter of reading what books were, you know, I started paying attention to the bestsellers list. I started reading the books that were on it. And I wasn't ever going to write a book just because it was a popular genre at the time. I mean, at the time it was actually, this is probably like 13 years ago, or no, like 10 years ago now. And I worked at women's magazines. So whenever I said I wanted to write a book, people would push me to writing a romance type book. And I was just like, you know, that's just not, I just don't feel that's the right direction for me. That's not the story that is calling to me. And so as I started to read more crime, and then as the genre has always been popular, obviously, but there was just suddenly some more like heightened awareness around women writing crime. And I was like, oh yes, this is the perfect, this feels right to me. So I think it was a little bit a question of right timing and luck that something, a voice and a type of book that spoke to me personally was also starting to do well in the marketplace.
And so now that you've had a book come out and it be as successful as it was, in writing your second one, you know, you have these, I don't want to say expectations from publishers and readers, but it is, they see another book coming out from Jessica Knoll and they have an expectation now. So while you were writing the second story, did you feel any pressure to kind of put maybe like threads and aspects of what you thought made the first book work into this one? Or did you feel confident like, no, I'm going to try and write a completely different story and people will understand and appreciate the fact that I'm a talented writer? I feel like sometimes people can write a successful novel and then feel like they have to recreate that for their next story.
Well, there was definitely a lot of pressure for the second book, and there were expectations this time around. And also, you know, something someone pointed out last night at my event, which I hadn't considered, was, you know, I started writing Luckiest Girl, when I was 27, and I'm 34 now. And so I had like 27 years of formulative experiences to draw from to write Luckiest Girl, and lots of time to think and marinate on that book. And then, you know, I kind of had like 2 years between the publication of that and turning in the first draft of The Favorite Sister to kind of figure out what I was going to write about for the second book. So it was definitely a much more condensed time period. And I think that I don't think I've really, I don't think, and no one had articulated that before, and I was like, oh yes, this probably explains why so many authors struggle with the second book, because we just have so much less time with it, or we feel like, you can always take as much time as you want, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like, you feel that, the heat, and so it feels like you have less time.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point, because I've spoke with so many debut authors who they'll tell me, you know, they could be 25, they could be 40, and they'll say, like, this is the story I've been building to my entire life. This is,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
this is the thing that, you know, I had 9 different manuscripts come and go, and I took little pieces from each of them. And then once you have that first book, everyone's like, all right, cool, that was great. Give me something else right now.
Give me something else. How about a year? Sure, I wrote the first book in the year, not thinking like that I was thinking on it, and I was, you know, I had all these aborted drafts for like 3 years before that, you know. So yeah, definitely that was going on with the favorite sister.
It always blows my mind when there's some authors out there that do. They'll have a book come out like every October, and I'm like, what is your life? I don't understand this.
I know. I want to know their secret too.
So, in regards to Luckiest Girl Alive, there is an adaptation of it coming out as a movie, and I know you're heavily involved. Is there any details you can give us about how that's going?
Just that there's a what they call a director's script, which means that I wrote a great script, and it's presentable to a director. It's approved by the studio. So yeah, I mean, there's always stuff going on behind the scenes, and we did have someone sign on and then drop off, which was heartbreaking, and we had to kind of start from square one all over again. But yeah, there is a great director reading it right now, and this person is showing a lot of interest, so we're hopeful, we're excited. And I just trust also that, you know, I have 2 great producers on this. I have Reese Witherspoon and Bruna Papandrea, mm-hmm. and they are telling me this is going to get made. We absolutely adore this project, and it is going to happen. And so I trust them. I'm excited to see what happens.
That was some incredible verbal dancing, not letting a director's name slip up, by the way. That was a really good job by you.
I've had some practice.
Okay, so we are a book podcast, so we always love asking, do you have any book recommendations, that either books you've read recently that you loved, or books that you've read over the past couple of years? Just when you have time to read, what's some of the stuff that gets you excited?
Yeah, well, I'm always reading, and I'm always excited when, like, a great new thriller comes out. That being said, I have to remind myself to branch out, because those are not the only books that I enjoy. And I did recently read Curtis Sittenfield's You Think It, I'll Say It, and I absolutely adored it. And the thing I think I love the most about it is it paced like a thriller, even though it's not. It's a collection of short stories, and some of them are funny, some of them are like heartbreaking, some of them are really wry, and they're all just kind of like a commentary on humanity. But each one has this kind of revelation in it. Like, you think it's like you form a first impression about a character, mm-hmm. and then throughout the course of this short vignette, your expectations are completely subverted. And I think I just responded really well to that. It just constantly kept me on my feet, and it's a collection of short stories, so that happened about 12 times throughout the book. So I read that like late into the night, the way I do a thriller. So I absolutely love that. And I was fortunate enough to score an early copy of the new Ruth Ware, which comes out at the end of this month, called The Death of Mrs. Westaway. And I've been reading that, and it's perfect because it's like raining in New York and it's a little chilly today. And so after we hang up, I am crawling back into bed and hunkering down with that.
I have to tell you, our conversation today will be released on Saturday, and for everyone listening to this, our Monday episode, literally 2 days after you, is my co-host having a conversation with Ruth Ware about that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Okay. And it was one of those situations. I love Ruth Ware, but my co-host Jill like adores her. So
right. When, you're like, okay, Jill, you take this one.
That was exactly what it was. A lot of these we'll do together, but some of them, like when I saw that you were coming on, I looked at her and she's like, you want to talk to Jessica by yourself? So I was like, kind of, a little bit. And so when Ruth came on, she looked at me, she's like, do you want to be a part of this conversation? And I was like, I think I'll just step on your toes and like, I'll let you fangirl without me. So yeah.
That sounds like a great working relationship there. Like, you're still flipping out
pretty well. I think it's because we both quietly will sass each other without getting in each other's face too much about it. So it works out well for us. Okay, at the end of our podcast, we always do what we call the Nerd Nine. So these are just 9 rapid fire questions, mainly because we like alliteration with naming things. So lighthearted, don't put a lot of thought in this, but the first one is, what's the last book you finished reading?
I mean, I think it was Curtin Sitton Field. Do you think it'll say it?
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite place to read?
My favorite place to read is the couch, and I like having the TV on in the background on mute. I don't know why, but that just feels very cozy and comfortable to me.
You and my wife would be great friends. I always ask her how she does that. You're the first person other than her who's ever
like, done. Why? I know. My husband's like, why is the TV even on? You're not watching it. The sound's not on. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it feels like it's companionship, and I'm always reading something scary, so I need to feel like there's another presence in the room.
That's fair. Okay. Do you remember the book that made you fall in love with reading?
The book that made me fall in love with reading? Probably Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar.
What's one place you'd like to travel that you have not yet been to?
Morocco, and Morocco is in the second book, and I wanted to travel there for research purposes, and then I couldn't make it work, but I'm dying to go.
I feel like you are in a situation where you could definitely throw your weight around with your publisher this next time around and be like, listen, this is important. Do you have a favorite holiday?
Halloween.
Are you a coffee person or a tea person?
Coffee.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
I actually knew the answer to that one because I definitely creeped on your adorable dog this morning. Oh my goodness.
I miss her so much.
Do you have a favorite food?
I have lots of favorite foods. probably if I had to pick, well, I'm more of a sweets person. Mm-hmm. So I would say I love these chocolate bottomed coconut maroons from this grocery store around the corner from my house in LA called Vicente Foods. They're absolutely like addictive.
That sounds wonderful. And then if you could have dinner with one person alive or dead, who would you pick?
Oh, one person alive or dead. Mm-hmm. This is always so tough.
I get yelled at for this one all the time. I'm sorry.
I know. Oh, my God. Because it's like I want to get, you know who I would pick in a heartbeat? Shirley Jackson.
Oh, that is, I'd never listened to it before, but I just listened to We Have Always Lived in the Castle, like, last week because I never listened to it. And now, I'm so mad I waited.
Oh, my God. It's so creepy and so good. And, yes, I would absolutely love to take her out for a stiff drink, take her away from all of her children and her husband who gave her no support, and we would have a wild girls' night together.
Well, and you know she would have, like, some elaborate meal planned out because her descriptions of food are so ridiculously good.
That's true. I would be well-fed with Shirley.
Yeah. Okay, the last question for you. What do you hope readers take away from The Favorite Sister?
So, The Favorite Sister is, it's a thriller, and there's a mystery, and it's really exciting to read, but it also has some deeper messaging if you're open to it and if you're looking for it. So I hope that readers have a fun time with it, and then for the readers who want more, that they appreciate the cult, you know, the things I'm trying to say about the culture and modern feminism.
That's perfect. Jessica, I know your schedule is completely jam-packed, so I really appreciate you taking some time and joining us today. I had a blast, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from Overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
Bonjour. This is Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. I'm Andrew Pryor, and every week I bring you the wonderful and fabulous people involved in French food, whether they're here in France like me or from around the world. Each week, we dive into a specific topic, be it a French dish, an ingredient, or a French cuisine cooking technique. My guests are all about French food. So, come join me on Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. Bon app.